The official score is in what the Congressional Budget Office thinks about the Senate health care bill. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 26th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Senate health care bill has been a matter of public record now for 4 days after having been written in secret. Today, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO in the vernacular, delivered what is called its score, also the vernacular there, by the way, its official estimate of the bill's impact on the healthcare economy. Sarah Cliff is a senior editor at Vox. She's also the co-host of a podcast they do called Weeds. She covers healthcare policy forum. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I'll tell you what, give me the headline numbers on this thing, would you?
Yeah, headline is the Senate health care bill would cause 22 million people to lose coverage, and it would also reduce the deficit by $321 billion.
Where does that stand as compared to the House version of this bill?
It is not that different. One of the things that's actually a little surprising is that they've had a little while to work on the Senate bill, and it looks really similar. The last estimate of the House bill had 23 million people losing coverage, so that number has gone down by 1 million, yeah. But it's still very far from where we are today.
Is this technically the version of the bill that they released on Thursday? You had a piece over the weekend talking about how they were revising and adding in some pieces that they had just left out because they legislated so fast.
Yeah, this is a little bit different than the Thursday bill. Earlier today, we found out they added in some waiting periods, some penalties for people who are uninsured. And this new CBO report does capture that, and it says that that increases coverage a little bit. But at the end of the day, we're looking at really significant coverage loss compared to the Affordable Care Act.
I wonder if, as we now are in, I don't even know what, like the third or fourth CBO version of health care bills going back to the first House bill, I wonder if some of these loss of coverage numbers kind of stop having meaning. They're so big and they're being repeated so often. It's a little bit like that old saying about spending in Washington, $1 billion here, $1 billion there. Pretty soon it's real money.
Yeah, and I think also one of the things that happens is you start benchmarking against what the last report said. So
right.
You say, oh, coverage went up a billion. You know, at the end of the day, I think most people benchmark against reality, kind of, do I have health insurance? Do I not have health insurance? But I think you're right, Kai, that you do see a bit of blaseness to the mm-hmm. numbers once you get them so many times in a row.
Detour with me into the politics of this for about a minute here. First of all, is Senator McConnell still thinking about a vote on Thursday for this thing?
From everything we know, he is. He is charging forward on that. I think we'll see how the score plays out as legislators get back into D.C. today and if they shake things up. But, yes, he has been very set on having this vote on Thursday.
Okay. Now, to the Medicaid cuts that come as a part of this bill, that is a thing that certainly Heller from Nevada and Senator Collins from Maine have talked about being deal breakers for them. Does this do anything to get them into Senator McConnell's fold?
It does not look like it. So most of the coverage loss that we see in this is from the Medicaid program. This new report estimates that 15 million people would lose Medicaid coverage. That's actually a little bit worse than the House bill. That's a result of some of the funding formulas they lose. So I'm sure for those senators concerned about the Medicaid program, this is not very welcome news.
Is there anything that stops this bill from passing, in all honesty?
I think a few senators opposing it. Mm-hmm. That's about all we have at this point. But it's interesting. We've seen these CBO reports come out. They get terrible coverage. Everyone says they're really bad reports for Republicans. But in the House, those reports came out, and they still passed the bill. So, mm-hmm. You know, this seems like bad news for Republicans, but certainly not the end of this debate.
Sarah Cliff, she's a senior editor at Vox. She covers healthcare policy forum. She does a podcast as well. It's called Weeds. It's pretty good. You ought to check it out. Sarah, thanks a bunch.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, moving on just a little bit. A little of this, a little of that. In the end, a whole lot of nothing really in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. White Houses in general, and this one in particular, when it's facing problematic news, like to have weeks, themed weeks, on the topic of this initiative or that. Branding of a kind. Think in just the past month or so of Infrastructure Week, of Jobs Week, Tech Week as well. This week is Energy Week for the Trump administration, with a series of events focused on building American energy dominance. The catch is, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Washington, we're already doing pretty well there.
So what does it mean to be energy dominant? It's not really a common term, so I asked Eric Smith, Associate Director of the Tulane Energy Institute in New Orleans.
I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think what it means is to give us the ability to successfully market our energy products, particularly the low-cost commodities, which ought to have a commanding role in the world economy.
Low-cost commodities like natural gas, which is cheap courtesy of the fracking boom. The U.S. is kind of already dominating the global energy market.
The United States has the world's largest reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas. We are now the world's largest oil and gas producer.
Myron Ebell is director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
These numbers are going to continue to go up. And as global demand for energy goes up around 2% per year, the United States is in a very strong position to become the major provider for that increased energy use around the world.
It was under the Obama administration that bans on exporting U.S. oil and gas were lifted. And really, global market forces dictate a lot more of what happens in the energy industry than what comes out of the White House, says Ed Herz. He's an energy economist at the University of Houston.
You know, it's very difficult to lead industry from Washington down when everything is based on profit margins, sales and revenues, infrastructures, investment.
So even if the Trump administration makes it easier to, say, drill in the Arctic, if it's not profitable, the energy industry will go its own way. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The global trade action today was in Spartanburg, South Carolina. BMW was celebrating the 25th anniversary of the announcement that it was going to build what has become the company's biggest plant in the world in Spartanburg. South Carolina GOP Senator Lindsey Graham was in town for the ceremony. He said this.
To those who fear globalization, embrace it because it's not going away. If you are looking for an example of how globalization can be a net positive for the American people, come to South Carolina.
Pretty interesting set of remarks, right, given what President Trump has said and done about globalization and America's place in it. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, states want as much of the world's investment as possible, no matter what the White House says.
President Trump has focused on trade as sort of a global zero-sum game where nations vie to sell exports. But there's another global game underway, the race for global investment dollars.
Being able to bring in foreign companies to manufacture, do R&D here, and employ U.S. workers is a big part of winning at the global economy.
Nancy McLernan is president of the Organization for International Investment, a trade association representing major global firms.
In 2000, the U.S. attracted 37% of the world's cross-border investment. And in 2015, we attracted about 22%. So we are definitely leaving some jobs on the global table.
Now, the U.S. is still the world's leader in attracting foreign dollars, and the total amount of investment we receive is rising. But as the global pie gets bigger, our slice of it is smaller. It's a slice of the global economy that state and local governments see as a jobs machine. Foreign companies pay higher wages and spend more on research and development than their U.S. counterparts. Daryl Curran is with Development Counselors International. They help cities, states, and countries attract business.
States have always competed for foreign direct investment, but I do believe the global battle for business is heating up.
Nancy McLernan says local politicians have often been more tuned in to foreign investment than politicians on the national stage.
For decades, all the pluses that the governor saw at the state level that foreign direct investment brings, somehow at the federal level, there seem to be some mixed messages.
So in other words, rhetoric in Washington doesn't always match reality on the ground. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Globalization, of course, the kind Senator Graham was talking about in South Carolina today, works both ways. Sometimes it's good for the United States, sometimes it's less good. 2 years ago, the only rare earth metals mine in this country filed for bankruptcy protection. The ongoing dispute over control of that mine's assets, and thus the ore it produces, centers on China's near monopoly of the rare earth element supply chain. Victoria Bruce is the author of a new book on that very topic. It's called Sellout. Victoria, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Kai.
We're going to start with a stipulation and a definition. The stipulation goes like this. You are trained in geology, so you know whereof you speak. And number two is you have to define rare earths for me because they are crucial to this narrative.
So rare earths are very sort of third row down, hidden behind a certain pullout column on the periodic table.
Assuming you know the periodic table, but anyway.
Right. Okay. So they're just very obscure. Into the 90s, though, they became ubiquitous in all of our technology. And that's because they have certain properties that allow very, very tiny magnets to be made. They allow lasers to be made. The problem is they are now completely controlled by China, and we need them for our military.
We used to have in this country a viable rare earths industry, right?
We did, but I would have to say it was a little bit before major technological companies needed the materials. So we have it. We have plenty of rare earths, but they're also mixed with thorium.
Thorium being radioactive.
Thorium being mildly radioactive, yes. But at this point, we have, you know, regulations against thorium that make it really, really costly to mine them here. So our mines are a lot more difficult to mine. China had its own rare earth deposits, and China's done this several times before. They drop the price and they put all the other mines out of business.
How did it come to pass that Washington decided, as you say in your title, America's technological soul was up for grabs?
What happened was this goes back to 1991. The Cold War's over. And I mean, it was just like a tsunami of technology leaving the country because these companies wanted access to what they needed. And they also wanted access to the Chinese marketplace, you know, which is huge. And at that point in Anderson, Indiana, there was a plant called MagnaQuench and a development that GM, General Motors, had made that was for the most important magnets in technological history. And we allowed that company to be bought by China. So China said, okay, now we have this company. Now what else do we need? Well, we need all the raw materials. So they now control from the basic, you know, raw materials all the way to the end products that go into, you know, all your fighters, all of our smart bombs, everything.
Take me from then 1990, 91-ish, where we started this tale, to today, right? Because China has the monopoly, say, on rare earths. What does it look like then for American industrial policy to be able to break that monopoly and get some control back here?
So it's not something that one mine can do, obviously. I mean, you're going up against China that has just oodles and oodles of the stuff, you know, the product itself, there's just tons of it. So it really needs some sort of consortium, some sort of, you know, major thought process of people working together. So our lawmakers are really going to have to step up and say, okay, but, you know, in the long run, if we don't have the products and if we don't have the things to manufacture and fabricate the ideas, we're going to go nowhere.
Victoria Bruce, her book is called Sellout. Vicky, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Coming up.
There's a shortage of violin teachers up here. I always have a waiting list.
It's sort of musical supply and demand with a healthcare backbeat. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 14 points today, less than a tenth percent, 21,409. The NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.2%, 62.47. S&P 500 up less than a point. We'll call that flat, 24.39. As I said on Friday, small moves are the name of the game these days. Arconic, which is one half of aluminum giant Alcoa's spinoff last year, said it's going to stop selling one type of aluminum cladding that was used on the outside of the apartment complex in London that caught fire, Grenfell Towers. That fire killed at least 79 people. Got to note that before I tell you this. Arconic shares down nearly 6% today. Takata, the Japanese company crippled by that massive airbag recall, filed for bankruptcy protection today. Company also announced it's going to sell itself to Key Safety Systems. That's a Chinese-owned American rival. Ford Motor Company up 1.25% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Nestle was one of the big gainers on Wall Street today, thanks mostly, all right, basically entirely, to a guy by the name of Daniel Loeb. That name is often prefaced by the phrase activist investor. Loeb announced over the weekend that his hedge fund, Third Point it's called, has bought $3.5 billion American dollars worth of shares in the Swiss food conglomerate and that he wants some changes. So yes, $3.5 billion is a whole lot of money, but it is just barely a 1% stake in Nestle. And yet, Loeb has managed to get management's attention. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what's going on here.
Most shareholders are considered passive. If they don't like how a company's being run, they sell their stock.
Activist investors, on the other hand, will make a lot of suggestions to try to drive improvements at the underlying company.
Jeff Graham wrote the book Dear Chairman about the rise of shareholder activism. He says the advice often starts out friendly, but things can get ugly fast with proxy fights to oust management or replace board members. Graham says even with Loeb's relatively small stake in Nestle, his reputation could win over other shareholders.
Dan Loeb does have a long track record of adding value and of having good investment returns, and I think that he will probably get a fair bit of support if it ever, you know, comes down to a fight.
Reputation only goes so far, says Nell Minow. She's vice chair of Value Edge Advisors, a corporate governance consulting firm. She says Loeb's ideas for Nestle, like selling its stake in cosmetics company L'Oreal, also have to make sense.
What matters is if you've got a story that's got a lot of appeal to the people that you want to come with you.
And there are plenty of unhappy shareholders who may want to come along. Financial advisor Thomas Russo has held shares in Nestle since 1987. He says for a year and a half, shareholders have been clamoring for change.
This is a refrain that has not surfaced with Dan. He put money on the table and went public.
And that publicity may be all the pressure Loeb needs to get at least some of what he wants. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One of then-candidate Trump's big selling points during the campaign was that he would take his business experience and turn it into governing experience. So indulge me for a minute here with a thought experiment in which, in a way, the president has gone from running a private company to running a public one of sorts. Yes, insert your government is not a business caveats here, acknowledged, so stipulated, yes, but we have called up John Paul Rollert. He teaches business ethics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business to chew this idea over. Good to have you on.
Great to be here.
So let me tell you where this interview came out of. We were sitting around the morning meeting one day, and we got to thinking about the presidency vis-a-vis a publicly traded corporation and how when companies go public, it is painful for them because then they have to answer to shareholders. They have to answer to Wall Street. They have to answer to a whole bunch of different people. And somebody at the meeting said, that's kind of like what's happening with the president. He now has to answer where previously he never did. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, as a person who for decades has run a privately held company, he can keep most of his business doings to himself. And now he finds himself in this situation where he's entirely obligated to make known his deliberations, his hiring decisions. And for someone who has always conceived himself as a deal maker, it's hard to make good deals if you essentially have to give a counterparty all the information that you have at your disposal. But I think in respect to the presidency, the question is, who exactly is on the other side of the deal?
Right. It's citizenry as customer, sort of.
Right, exactly. Right.
You used an interesting word. You said the president is obligated to make those disclosures, to have those conversations. Yet I think what you're seeing, and let's just pick this example of the White House press briefings now being off camera and sometimes without audio included, it appears that lesson has not yet been learned.
Well, that's true. But I think that what you're referring to are a series of customs and norms around public disclosure that we see the president chafing at. Now, and it's true, a lot of these customs have kind of recent parentage. I think it's only during the Clinton administration that mm-hmm. you actually had daily televised press briefings. But I think the broader idea that the public has a right to know the deliberations of the president and the people around him and how he's coming to his decisions seems to me a pretty important democratic norm.
Extend for me then my somewhat imperfect metaphor of the presidency and the publicly traded corporation that I started with. What's the impact on the presidential bottom line, if you will, of a continued deterioration of norms and transparencies?
Well, you know, it probably depends on whose perspective you take. I mean, certainly presidents love to keep a lot of their deliberations private, but I'd like to believe that most of them recognize that when you're a democratically elected leader and you're making decisions that certainly don't have unanimous consent, you owe it to the broader public to explain how you reach those decisions.
The market has a way of correcting corporate behavior. You know, if you put out a bad product, consumers won't buy it, you will pay a price. What's the remedy here for this type of behavior on the part of the executive?
Well, I mean, the most obvious market correction comes on election day. But of course, for them to reach intelligent decisions in the same way stockholders need to be able to reach intelligent decisions, you actually have to have the correct information about the ways in which decisions are being arrived at. In the same way that the SEC mandates that publicly traded companies make that information available to stockholders, the law and certainly custom demands that that information is made available to voters, and it should.
John Paul Rollard, he teaches business ethics at the Chicago Booth School of Business. John Paul, thanks very much for your time.
Great to be here, Kai.
We're going to take our Every Now and Then series that we've been doing for the past couple of years called My Economy. It's all about how people are getting by in their day-to-day. And we're going to turn it, given the news of the day, to healthcare. Here you go.
My name is Rebecca Dunn, and I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I have two jobs, a music teacher, and I also work as a publications technician for the state of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game. I don't make a whole lot of money, but I have good benefits. This is a university town. It's, I think, 80,000 people in Fairbanks. So there's a lot of really highly educated people for a city this size. And that makes for a great arts community. I make about a third of my income teaching music, and there's a shortage of violin teachers up here. I always have a waiting list. When the Affordable Care Act was first passed, I was seriously considering not having this second job. I consider myself a musician first, and if I could just teach music full-time, I definitely would. But even if I made twice as much money doing that, I still couldn't afford health insurance. And in Alaska, you know, it's pretty expensive. Everything's more expensive in Alaska. Things are so uncertain. Looks like if the American Healthcare Act actually passes, that Alaska is going to be in pretty bad shape. And so I'm going to be really super happy that I still have employer healthcare.
Rebecca Dunn, she's in Fairbanks, Alaska. Take a second, if you got it, and send us the story of your economy, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy.
Sports final note on the way out today. Small favors, I guess. Google said over the weekend that it's going to stop scanning your Gmail account for keywords to help it target ads to you. First of all, if you weren't aware, and Mom, I'm looking at you. Yes, Google does scan your account. It's automated, not somebody reading your actual email. Second of all, yeah, privacy and ickiness and all of that. But it's been going on since 2004. The company said it would stop, quote, later this year. All right, that's it. We got to go. Whole lot of nothing on Wall Street today. The Dow up less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ down about 0.2%. S&P 500 pretty much completely flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.